Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it's now or never, and we're literally in the throes of the 14th Amendment. And the most contested amendment, I know it's not, well, actually, I think it's equally contested and hated, more so than it should be, and I know it ranks right up there with the 17th and the 16th Amendment. And actually, that brings me back to our special guest, Angeline Marie.
Yes.
Did I get that right? Because I'm really...
Yes.
Okay. In my age, names are one of those things that elude me. Okay, so one of the things we talked about in the last episode was regarding taxation and all of that. And so one of the things that most people that aren't really literate regarding the Constitution, they don't understand how the 16th Amendment is actually, the way they're executing the 16th Amendment, it actually violates the Constitution. So one of the most contended issues regarding the Constitution with the Anti-Federalists, and one of the, I'll say, the arguments that got traction for them was the fact that there was a direct tax. The Constitution clearly says that they have the ability to direct tax with duties, imposts, and excise. And so a duty is a direct tax. And when they created the 16th Amendment, the 16th Amendment actually allowed, it converted the direct tax or the duty to be placed onto a state to where they put a duty upon a person, where a person made an income. And I haven't done the full due diligence regarding, you know, what that really means as far as a person's gain or what have you, and the nuances like Adele may have if he's actually gone through the 16th Amendment debates in Congress. But I will tell you that the people that wrote that one particular amendment were very, very illiterate, because they went in saying, oh, well, you know, this is just going to be a flat tax on income. And as soon as they applied the tax, it was progressive. And the reason why this is a violation of the Constitution is when you look at Article 1, Section 8, the very first part is what we call the preamble to the powers. It is the very first section of that. And it says that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts, and to provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. In other words, they cannot, the 16th Amendment did not grant them the ability to go beyond the uniformity of that tax. So in other words, the only way they could apply that tax is basically a 5% to 10% tax for all. And having said that, when they started creating this progressive tax, and one of the things that it didn't do, but they quickly came around the corner and they said, you know, corporations have income as well, because this is where they wanted to actually be able to start controlling corporations, and they needed to get corporations to become individuals so that individuals could then function as international dual citizen or multi-citizen status within the United States, because that was the opening, the progressive era was the opening of setting the stage for globalism. And it was going to be corporations that were going to basically take over all governments and, you know, all things that we see. And that's why...
Isn't that what these sovereigns say, that they made individuals corporations?
Yes, yes.
That's why their name is in all caps on everything?
Well, so, yeah, they started going down... I don't know if there was a legal beagle or what have you. Somebody made the decision that we're going to differentiate by using all caps and all that other stuff. It doesn't matter. None of that is legitimate. What they do, what they're doing, are outside the boundaries or the confines of the Constitution. They've never been granted those authorities to do those things. So even though the 17th and the 16th Amendment allowed the federal government to be able to tax or shift from a duty to a state based on the percentage. Instead, they said, we're going to tax directly to the income of the individual bypassing you. And they got the states to buy into it. But they didn't get the states to buy into, or I should say, they didn't put it out there that they were going to violate the uniformity clause. Nowhere in there were they given or granted the ability to have progressive taxation. Nowhere in the language of the 16th Amendment did they get the authorization or ask for the authorization to be able to apply taxes however they saw fit, which is how they've, you know, they've out the gate, I believe they were taxing rich people, you know, 70% or something like that. It got up there, probably even 90%. It really got up there pretty quick within the first 5 years. And so it was so bad that people started hiding their taxes. And this is when they started going after corporations because they were basically, you know, living under a little stipend from the corporation and protecting all of their money at the corporate level. But anyway, so the whole point that I was going down this path with the 16th Amendment is the fact that not that they're not right, there's bigger problems that nobody talks about. The fact that the federal government does have the ability to direct tax, it's right in the Constitution, but they cannot have progressive taxation. And I have to go through, because I've never gone through the debates, whether they have the ability to directly tax income or whether it's gains or what have you. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm just, you know, trying to get everybody equally informed. Most people just contest the ability for them to tax, and or there's the libertarians that say taxation is theft. Well, so no government actually needs the tax, and it was a legitimate need, and it was necessary, and, you know, so it was integrated into the Constitution, but they don't have the ability to tax for things that they don't have the authority to spend on. That's fraud. And mm-hmm. So the reason why they're so aggressive, because, and this was the whole premise behind the 16th Amendment, and I'm kind of leaning forward on this since we're doing the 14th Amendment now, but when we look at the history of the 16th Amendment, Wilson was literally spending, and the previous presidents were spending their way into prosperity, or they're basically trying to buy America into prosperity. And so Wilson said, hey, you know, this new paradigm, he says, we're going to basically create, you know, this unlimited bank account, and we're going to spend our way into prosperity. But the one thing we need is we need to temporarily institute an income tax. And so we're just going to do this. And as soon as we get to the point where everybody is prosperous, then we'll stop. And that was the big lie right there. But right. The whole idea of buying our way into prosperity by basically printing more and more money was a fool's errand as well. So, anywho, I think that we can probably just move into the 14th Amendment and wrap that up. But I thought it was important to kind of bring this up. The 17th Amendment equally, and I don't want to spoil that because we're going to get into that as well. The 17th Amendment is another progressive era amendment that literally violates the U.S. Constitution. And I'm not going to spoil that, but I mean, you probably want to listen to it because it literally violates a part of the Constitution. So it's so problematic. Both of these amendments were created because they needed to do this, but they didn't know how to do it right to function within the Constitution. So what really happens when you look at it, and what should have happened is if they had anybody that was literate at the time say, this amendment can't fly. The states could have easily challenged and said, this amendment can't fly because it contrasts or conflicts with another part of the Constitution. You can't have the law conflict with itself. So, anyway, does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right, so at this point, going into the 14th Amendment, we're ready for Section 3. And if you want to go ahead and read that, yeah, go ahead, please.
Section 3, no person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state, who having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature, or as an executive or judicial officer of any state, to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, but Congress may by a vote of 2/3 of each house remove such disability.
Okay, so starting from the end, this section creates a disability. It doesn't create a fine. It doesn't take away your liberty or your life. It creates a disability. And in today's words, this section creates a standard of eligibility. In other words, when we look at the requirements of somebody's eligibility to serve, or the qualifications of somebody to be qualified to be in office for a representative, it's 25 years of age and a U.S. citizen and has to be a citizen for so many years, correct? So this right here adds a criteria for a person to be able to maintain their position in any of these offices. So what this is doing is it's not necessarily this is not a law or punishment. There's nowhere here where a person is required to have due process. Case in point, if the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, decides to move up to New York and resides in New York while he's still governor, is he still governor?
I would say no.
No, by the day he actually changes his resident to New York, whether he's resigned or not, he's no longer eligible to be governor. Now, does he go to jail? No, he just is removed from the emoluments of office. In other words, it's the same thing as an impeachment, really. You're removing a person from the office and the emolument entitlements that come with that. You know, the pay, the privileges, and those types of things. Now, this right here basically just states that if you create, well, we'll get into that, but it identifies who this criteria applies to. It says no senator or representative in Congress or elector of president. So who's an elector of a president and vice president? Well, that's our electoral college. See, one of the things that's completely lost today is people go, well, what does that mean? That means that we're supposed to actually be voting for an elector. In other words, that person that is selected as an elector is selected by we the people. This is why we went through the ratification base. We actually proved that the electors are to be chosen by the people, not the party. And the way our whole electoral college has been perverted. I mean, we're not even following the electoral college process at all. Not at all. And so the electors are equally susceptible and can be removed if they do what they're not supposed to do in what Section 3 talks about. So moving on to who else? The elector or hold any office. So in other words, anybody that's in office, whether they be civil or military, at the federal level. So we're still talking about the federal level under the United States, because that's what under the United States. So all of that's federal level, meaning that the Secretary of State, the Secretary of the Treasury, or anybody that has to take an oath of office. And in those days, if you go through the very first act of administrating the act, so a long time ago, earlier this year, I actually pointed out that the very first act that Congress committed was the act of regulating and administering the oaths of office. So in other words, if you didn't know, you know, when you look at, you know, a governing body, when they first form, usually they do the most important stuff first. And so it really tips your hand as to what's really important. And what was important to the framers when they created the federal government was the oath of office, because that was the very first act that they produced. And they actually laid out who was to actually take an oath of office. And practically everybody was. The clerks, everybody had, I mean, that was involved in the federal government, they all had to take an oath. So what this is basically saying is anybody in office or in the military under the United States, and now they go into the states or under any state, who having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as any state, because they go through the listing again, and I think this is really redundant, but they kind of list again a member of Congress or as any officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state. And then, boom, they're kind of done listing. But they kind of repeat it twice. Anybody that takes an oath at the federal level or at the state level, they shall not be in that position when that goes into this clause of why. They have to support the Constitution. So anyway, if they take this oath to support the Constitution of the United States, shall having engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, meaning the Constitution. In other words, if they're rebelling against the Constitution, violating the Constitution, or, you know, ignoring the Constitution and doing otherwise, and then there's this little clause or this little comment says, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, the enemies of the Constitution, then they're no longer eligible. But Congress may, by a two-thirds vote of each house, remove this disability. So they're basically just saying you can't serve at all. They were laying this out that if you violated, now most people would take this, and I've listened to a lot of legal beagles, and they love dissecting what this really says, and they say, oh, this was applied to those guys that actually rebelled. This does not apply to today. And actually, I have the language of the original 13th Amendment, and it's very clear in that language that says those who supported the rebellion, the language changed halfway through because it literally stated that you could not be in office if you supported the rebellion of the South, this recent rebellion. The reason why they actually changed it and took away the pointing to the recent rebellion is that this would have created an ex post facto law. Was there a law in the Constitution that said that you couldn't secede and or support your secession with, you know, military force or what have you? In other words, if the North would have attacked you, you could not have, you know, basically fought back. And there's no law. There was no law in the Constitution that kept a state from seceding, nor was there a law that stated that you couldn't defend yourself. So the North, they were kind of really upset. I mean, putting aside, you know, all of the emotions and everything else, they were just upset. And there were a lot of guys that just wanted to make it impossible for the Southern people, or I should say the Southern politicians, to come back into the federal government, whether that be at the military level or anything else. And, it, you know, calmer heads about halfway through the process said, you know, how many, actually, I think it was stated by Howard. Howard asked, how many people have to hang before we're okay with, you know, letting them do their jobs? And it kind of invoked some thought, and it got people to get a little bit cooler and say, okay, so, you know, we can't necessarily, just because we didn't have a law, say you violated the law. You may have violated some code, but it was unwritten. So we have to create a code now for moving forward, and that is the whole point of Section 3. I hope I made sense on this, that the whole point of Section 3 was to ensure that there would never, ever be an insurrection against the Constitution ever again. And in very specific context, this has nothing to do with secession. This has everything to do with violating your oath of office and not supporting the Constitution.
Which it seems happens every day.
Oh, right, absolutely. Now. Absolutely. So as soon as the 14th Amendment got passed, there were many states like Missouri, they passed an amendment to their constitution to basically state that anybody that violated their oath were to be removed. So they started actually putting this into many of the states. But, you know, they quickly realize, you know, it's nice to be on the high ground, but come on, give me some latitude. And instantly they stopped enforcing this. And as a matter of fact, down the road going into the 1900s, the federal government was cherry picking very specific things that they would, you know, kick you out. I mean, because they actually did enforce this. You can go through the records and find out where people were removed for violating their oath at the federal level or at a state level. But they really made a concerted effort to bury this so that nobody knew that we could literally hold them to their oath, that if they voted in Congress to do something other than what the Constitution prescribes. And I'll give you a good case in point. The invasion on the southern border is required to be dealt with. And as a matter of fact, the Constitution in Article 4 states that every state in this union is guaranteed a Republican form of government. The United States guarantees to them a Republican form of government and shall protect each from an invasion. So in other words, Congress is obligated to protect us from this invasion on their southern border. Well, they've redefined it. They don't call it an invasion. They call it a border crisis. They call it an immigration crisis. But when people come across it, immigration is an individual responsibility. When you want to immigrate to a nation, you have to apply to that nation to say, I want to become a citizen. If not, and you're just running across the border, you're becoming a trespasser. In other words, you are an invader. You have no intention. There's no paperwork. There's nothing like that. These people are just coming here because they're being basically hoodwinked by the federal government. Say, if you come here, we're going to let you stay. And that's exactly what's happening. We're supporting our own invasion and supporting our own undermining, violating the Constitution, the whole process. And so until people actually start putting context to this, because Article 1, Section 8 literally states that the Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. So they're not only obligated to protect the states, they're obligated to repel the invasion by calling forth the militia. And so what they're doing in allowing people to cross that border, they are violating their oath of office. There's no way around it. I mean, you can't find a logical or reasonable explanation that allows them to stay in office. They have to be removed based on Section 3 because the Constitution demands that that invasion be repelled. Oh, well, we redefined it. Well, the Constitution doesn't let you redefine things. As a matter of fact, under the essence of contract law, if it is stipulated during the process of accepting that contract that this line means something very specific, like in the ratification debates, that becomes a legally binding definition. And so when the court comes along and says, well, it doesn't really mean that, it means something else, they don't have the authority to do that. The only entity that has the authority to determine if it means something else are the states themselves, and the only process they can change that with is an amendment. And because we've never amended the Constitution in redefining these things, this is the magnitude of the mess we have. Any comments on that?
Well, this Section 3 to me is the linchpin for things that we're going through today.
Correct, correct.
I don't know if you heard, I think their name is Brunson, the Brunson brothers.
Yes. I've interviewed one of them, yeah. Yeah, I know who they are.
Yeah, and I think they were going on this breach of oath of office. I think that was the whole foundation for their case.
Yeah, kind of. It was about the undermining, because they were pointing to a conspiracy to undermine the election of the president, and there's so many different problems that, you know, we've changed our own vernacular when we look at the president. Like when we see people that are taking a legal standing and saying, hey, you know, they undermined the election of the president. There is no such thing in the Constitution as the election of a president. That would be a democracy where we, the people, would be voting for the president. We don't. We do unconstitutionally. But the Constitution has been changed, and even we have adopted those unconstitutional changes and accepted them. All we have to do is go back to, I'll just call the Constitution, the scriptures, and say the letter of the law says that we're to choose our electors, and our electors are to choose the president and the vice president separately. When we start living by that law, I think all of a sudden things literally change. There's no latitude for the parties to actually reduce or eliminate candidates for the presidency. But they use primaries to do that. They use primaries to create tickets. There's no latitude in the Constitution for any of this. I mean, this is... But because they constantly use the same terminology, we've kind of gone down this path of agreeing. And so this is why I got tied to a lawsuit with Bob Schultz and Tony Fucia of We the People Foundation up in upstate New York, in the northern portion of New York, up by Syracuse. And we sued Congress over the First Amendment petitions and over the Electors Clause, because the Electoral College Clause was being violated. And instead of claiming, you know, voter fraud and the election, you know, I'll just say scandals and all of this, because bottom line, there's no jurisdiction for the court at all over any of this. But there is jurisdiction for the court over the Electoral College, because that's actually in the Constitution. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I applaud these guys for trying to do something, but it would have a better impact if they actually, you know, went into the Constitution and said this right here very specifically is being violated. Because when I looked at their charge, I said, okay, that's not something the court has jurisdiction over. I mean, the federal government should not be allowing the states, and they should be holding the states accountable to the Electoral College. Period. And we don't even do that. So anyway... and really the process is not going to, because one of the things I'm going to cover right after the amendments in the Constitution, I'm going to cover the process of republic review, of what we have to do to get the states to get into becoming the parents, or, you know, stepping back into their responsibility over the Constitution and forcing the federal government into compliance. There's a lot of things we have to change. And I'm just telling people that, you know, we won't be voting for president anymore. And as a matter of fact, it really shouldn't matter, you know, who is president, as long as, you know, he is held accountable to his oath of office. Because Congress can't give us stuff. And every congressman that's given us stuff and every president that's given us stuff has actually violated their oath of office, because their powers come from the Constitution. When Obama gave us Obamacare, he directly, and Congress directly, violated the Constitution. And when the Supreme Court defended it and said, oh, well, it's acceptable because it's a tax, all of these folks were violating their oath of office. And I'll tell you, a lot of these people know it. In Congress, maybe not, but I think at the court level, and there's no doubt in my mind, Obama, who taught the Constitution, knows how to undermine it, so he has to understand it. The sad part is that we had a president that his heart was maybe in the right spot, but he didn't even understand the Constitution at all, and he brought in advisors and people around him as, you know, his cabinet, which is Trump, that, and they didn't understand the Constitution, or at least they had their own agenda in using unconstitutional powers to do what they wanted to do. And it just exposed him. It's kind of like, you know, we see how the left is protected when they go out and protest. But the right, if they go out and they actually peacefully assemble and go to Congress to petition them, they're going to be arrested. And they literally went through a January 6th trial of good patriots who did a poor execution of a petitioning government for the redress of grievances. They had the constitutional right to be there. As a matter of fact, Congress can make no law abridging that right. And so when they locked those doors of the halls of Congress to keep them from even entering, Congress itself actually violated the Constitution. They were the ones committing the insurrection by abridging the right of the people to petition them. You can't do that. The Constitution is clear. The people's right cannot be abridged, cannot be diminished by locking the doors. So and why is it that the lawyers that are all arguing this, they all go along with it? Because they're all a part of the Bar Association. You know what the bar stands for?
You told me it was British something.
Yeah, the British accredited something, accreditable or something. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Registry is what the R stands for. And so the American bar is just, I'll just say, this larger cesspool, or it's a part of this large cesspool of how our laws are being controlled by the courts instead of by we the people.
And as long as we remain ignorant, we don't have our power back.
That is correct. And so
how do we turn the ship around?
Well, okay, so that's not that hard. This goes down to the Republic review process. So let's finish, because there's two more parts to this, and whatever's left, I will kind of give you as much as I possibly can of what the process really is. And so,
okay, so you want me to read section four?
Section four, yes, because this right here actually flies in the face of some of the assertions of those who speak badly about the 14th Amendment, and, you know, the fact that we became a part of this brought us into an allegiance of the British government, which this actually states otherwise. Go ahead.
Okay. Section 4, the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. But neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss or emancipation of any slave, but all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void.
So, did it differentiate between those who participated in the southern states, or did they basically draw the line that no state in this union?
Or any state.
There you go. So in other words, this right here was the little irresistible object that the southern states had to take. This was the bitter pill that they had to take, because they put it in here that if they didn't join the union again, then they would not be protected from the collection of debt from Britain. Because it says right here that neither the United States nor any state shall assume. So in other words, if they're in the union, they're a state in the union, they shall be protected. It wiped out all that foreign debt, just like that.
So are you saying in present day, when they say that a lot of our tax money is going to the British, that is not true?
No, I'm not saying that it's not true. I am saying that this right here forced the southern states to come into the Union, and then the southern states turned around and said, hey, we're a part of the United States, and we no longer are obligated to pay you. And right. Britain was fit to be tied. I'm telling you, they... This was the final point. The Radical Republicans was the final. It was almost like the sun was, you know, beaming its brightest on the Union. And so this is when Britain realized that they either had to go to war, and I believe they calculated, even in our ragtagged condition that we were in, especially the South, that they may have been able to wage war against us, but it would have committed all of Britain and probably all of the rest of the hostile countries that hated America to be committed to actually fighting a war here on the American soil. And I think that they said, you know what? We're going to, because at this point in time, Britain had already been having their intelligence operators in America. As a matter of fact, prior to, you know, the expansions, where was Britain before we actually got the Louisiana Purchase? Britain was already to the west of us. They were out in the plains working with the Indians, convincing the Indians to harass us and to cause problems. I mean, they were manipulating all around us in trying to basically harass us to a point where we would be frustrated and prepared to probably surrender if they attacked us again. And the 1812 war basically proved to them that that's not going to work, that they just don't have the resources to come to America and control it, to actually sit here and occupy the land and say, this is now Britain. Because that's what you have to do. Back in those days, you had to occupy and control the land. And they just didn't have the resources to do it. As we kept on growing and expanding, it became a bigger problem for them. And so by the time the Civil War came along, they go, there's just no way. There's not enough armies in the world that they could coerce to get. I mean, even if everybody was willing to do it, they just wouldn't have the armies to do it. America was a big country. And so to come here and to successfully, and that was back in the day when gun power was equal. I mean, my musket shot just like your musket. Today, we don't have the same weaponry. I mean, we've advanced so much and innovated so much in weaponry that things have really changed. And this goes to the divine hand of providence. There's no doubt in my mind that the divine hand of providence knew what we would be facing and how bad these times would be. And he gave us everything in this Constitution to actually take this country back without having to fight a revolution. And it comes to the beautiful thing under the concept of a contract. A contract has been with mankind since Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden. I mean, probably even longer than that, you know, from heaven and so forth. I mean, it is a fundamental tenet of humans dealing with each other. And I think it pre-exists, but not to get into the biblical side of all of this. The fact is that there is a natural recourse when your contract is being violated. So what mm-hmm. do you do? And most people, because the way we've been programmed, we don't think outside the box when it comes, or we don't actually look at the nature of the compact itself. So I don't want to pollute the pool here. What do you think we should do when all of a sudden our contract's being violated?
I think we should take whatever steps to point out those violations, because that's where the power is. But I think people are just ignorant, and that's all on purpose. I mean, look who controls the education.
Yes. Yeah, so... what I was looking for, because what most people would do, and you know what the intelligentsia, the left, and all of these people out there, what they would do is they would basically say, "Oh, we got to go to the court. You have to go to court."
Right.
And I'm here to tell you, no. As a matter of fact, Madison, if you read the resolutions of 1798, and this is the history on this, because we already covered this before we went into the Constitution. We covered Jefferson's Kentucky Resolution. So that show is out there for you to download and listen to. And then we covered the Virginia Resolutions, and then we ran out of time. It was time for the constitutional season to read the Constitution, you know, through it, through and through. And so we're kind of wrapping that up now that we've, you know, well over halfway. But the resolutions of Kentucky and Virginia basically fell flat. And the reason they fell flat was because the corruption of government had already seeped in. And the people, when they finally realized what had happened, they didn't like it. And I can prove this, because what ended up happening in 1798, when the Alien and Sedition Acts were passed, Jefferson wrote a letter and he sent it to, and these were the resolutions of Kentucky. He sent it to the Kentucky State Legislature at the end of October of 1798, and November 10th, the Kentucky Legislature passed it and sent it out to all of the states. So in other words, they only had it for 2 weeks to debate, and they got it out. And it went out to all of the states. Now, by the time it got to Virginia, Virginia actually prepared resolutions from November 10th. It went out. They responded in kind with their own resolutions at the end, I think it was December 25th, Christmas Day. Well, that, back in those days, they didn't recognize Christmas. Christmas was not a holiday. And so December 25th, because they were working, they actually sent a response to the Kentucky resolutions. And this was Madison. He actually sat down and worked with the committee or the legislature and said, look, you know, we have an obligation as a legislature, or you, because he wasn't a part of them. He says, you have an obligation because you're the party to the compact. When you look at the Article 7 clarifies who the parties are, because the party has to ratify. Did we, the people, ratify the Constitution? No, it says the states. It said 9 of the 13 states would be sufficient to make this Constitution valid. And so the states had to ratify it. Now, did they take it to the people? No, again, they took it to the representatives of the people because we were Republican informed. So that's why when you look at the ratification debates, it was the who's who of politics at the time. It wasn't the common man that debated the Constitution. It was those who understood these things. And so these people trusted these people, and these were really good, righteous men. And so they ratified the Constitution, and it got unanimously ratified. That means that all the states that joined the Union are the parties to it based on Article 7. And because they're the parties to it, it is up to them, because this is what Madison said. And this is in his report. So what happened was, as all of the states came back to Kentucky and Virginia and said, you know, we think you guys are treasonous. We think you guys have gone way over the line. And they made all sorts of insinuations. So in 1799, Jefferson wrote another resolution that went out, and he basically called him out for using such insinuations that insulted him, where he lamented. And I mean, these are really powerful, a very powerful point in the birth or in the infant stages of America. And Madison went on, and this is what he said in his response to these other states, because the Virginia legislature said, hey, look at what we got. You know, can you give us some information? So he basically sent his report on what they were doing and why. And this is what he basically said. And this is very powerful. He says that it appears to your committee or the state legislature to be a plain principle founded in common sense, illustrated by common practice, and essential to the nature of compacts, that where the resort can be had to no tribunal superior to the authority of the parties themselves must be the rightful judges in the last resort, whether the bargain made or whether the contract made been pursued or violated. The Constitution of the United States was formed by the sanction of the states, given by each in its sovereign capacity. It adds to the stability and dignity, as well as the authority of the Constitution, that it rests on this legitimate and solid foundation. the states then being the parties to the constitutional compact, and in their sovereign capacity, it follows of necessity that there could be no tribunal above their authority to decide in the last resorts whether the compact made by them be violated, and consequently, that as the parties to it, they must themselves decide in the last resort such questions as may be sufficient magnitude to require their interposition. Now, interposition doesn't mean nullify. It means using whatever political forces and measures to force compliance. And so in this particular case, they didn't have Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So they were basically going to be riding upon the, hopefully, the honor and integrity of these men. And at this point in time, they still had men of honor and integrity. I mean, this was the day when you challenged somebody, you could call them out for a duel. And so if these guys didn't answer up, they could call them out for a duel or something. But the need for Section 3 was critical so that the states could actually say, you're no longer eligible to serve us in Congress. And this is how we clean up Congress, is by basically using Section 3. Article 4 of the Constitution empowers the states to charge Congress with felonies and or treason and extradite them back to the state. And when they get extradited back to the state, the governor has the power and authority to replace them. And in that process, if Congress isn't going to do their job in supporting the Constitution, as the states get more and more on board with demanding full compliance, I know the elixir is going to be tough. But if we don't do this, we will never have liberty, and we will be subjugated by a heel of government that is unimaginable. That, you know, we have to do this, bottom line. Or, you know, I hate to imagine what life would be like under the globalist government for any of us patriots who want liberty. But let me close with this, because I've still got a few minutes. Now, there was some questions and pushback from the states that said, hey, you guys, we don't have this authority. The Supreme Court has the authority, and they basically insinuated that it was treasonous to actually bypass the court. So later on in this exact same report, Madison kind of points out that, you know, it was being objected, and this is what he said, but it is objected that the judicial authority is to be regarded as the sole expositor of the Constitution in the last resort. And it may be asked for what reason the declaration by the General Assembly, the General Assembly is talking about the state legislature of Virginia, supposing it to be theoretically true, could be required at the present day and in so solemn a manner. On this objection, it might be observed first that there may be instances of usurped power from which forms the Constitution would never draw within the control of the judicial department. Secondly, that if the decision of the judiciary be raised above the authority of the sovereign parties to the Constitution, the decisions of the other departments not carried by the forms of the Constitution before the judiciary must be equally authoritative. In other words, if the judiciary gets away with it, the other departments will get away with it as well. But this is what he says. But the proper answer to the objection is that the resolution of the General Assembly, or this Virginia resolution, relates to those great extraordinary cases in which all the forms of the Constitution may be proved ineffectual against infractions dangerous to the essential rights of the parties to it. The resolution supposes that dangerous powers not delegated may not only be usurped and executed by the other departments, but that the judicial department also may exercise or sanction dangerous powers beyond the grant of the Constitution, and consequently, that the ultimate right of the parties to the Constitution to judge whether their compact has been dangerously violated must extend to the violations of one delegated authority as well as by another, by the judiciary as well as the executive or the legislature. However true, therefore, it may be that the judicial department is in all questions submitted to it by the forms of the Constitution. In other words, they have jurisdiction of all things of the Constitution to decide in the last resort. This resort must necessarily be deemed in the last resort to the authorities of the parties of the department, not the government. not in relation to the rights of the parties to the constitutional compact from which the judicial as well as the other departments hold their delegated trust. So in other words, he's saying that both the judiciary or all three, the judiciary, executive, and legislative, get their authority from the states on which any other hypothesis the delegation of judicial power would annul the authority delegating it. In other words, when they come along and say, well, you don't have the authority, they're deriving their authority from us. And by saying that they annul our authority, they've annulled their own power. And so he says, and the occurrence of this department with the others in usurped powers might subvert forever and beyond the possible reach of any rightful remedy the Constitution, which all are instituted to preserve. This is his final. This is the final comment I'm highlighting for you out of this. He says, it will be remembered that a frequent recurrence to fundamental principles like contract law is solemnly enjoined by most of the state constitutions, and particularly by our own, as a necessary safeguard against the danger of degeneracy to which republics are liable, as well as to the governments through a less degree than others, and a fair composition of the political doctrines not frequent at the present day, with those which characterize the epoch of our revolution and form the basis of our republican constitutions, will best determine whether the declaratory recurrence here made to those principles ought to be viewed as unreasonable and improper or as a vigilant discharge of an important duty. And this is the final point here. He says, the authority of constitutions over governments and the sovereignty of the people over constitutions are truths which at all times necessary to be kept in mind, and at no time perhaps more necessary than at present. So in other words, what he's saying is that the Constitution rules the government. It is where the government derives its power, and the sovereignty of the people over constitutions, where the constitutions get their legitimacy. And so if we keep everything into perspective and we actually get everything back in a line in that perspective, then we will actually save the Constitution. It's about forcing compliance. So we got about 2.5 minutes left. Did that help? Does that kind of help, you know, to explain that it's the states that absolutely have to coalesce? And I'm going to use the word convention. It's going to be an online convention. In Republic Review, the whole process that is built off of what Madison and Jefferson were doing is right there on Reclaiming the Republic, right there on the homepage. And you can go to the Constitutional Articles page and download exactly the argument for it and the one step to the next step to the next step, what the process is. And there's even a flow chart. As one step basically says, that's it, we've had enough, we demand full compliance, then they actually start cleaning their own house because there's nobody in that state that's going to be allowed to do anything other than comply to their oath of office to the Constitution. Now, at this point, the state can't nullify laws, but it doesn't have to participate. And so bottom line, this state has to basically appeal to all the states like David to other Davids, that we need more Davids to slay this Goliath. And technically, we need 27. We need enough states to control both houses of Congress to where we can actually extradite them and replace them, those who choose to not abide by their oath of office and use the Constitution as the supreme law of the land to remove them and force them to dismantle and disband the Department of Education, the Department of Housing, all of these unconstitutional roles, responsibilities, and powers. Even judges, the laws that come from the judge. Like he said, it's not just one usurpation just by Congress, the usurpation of creating laws from a bench that has no authority to create laws, or the executive to create laws. So executive orders have violated, the states will have to literally go through, and the key word is an audit. They have to actually go through everything that the federal government has done after they've looked at the Constitution and said, okay, this is all they can do. And when it comes down to, oh, they created a law, they don't have the authority for that, then boom, it's a bad law. We have to get rid of it. And then they have this disposal bucket or trash bin that they basically, one at a time, say, this whole department, that's trash. You've got to get rid of that. And all of those things will then start coming back to the states. And the taxation and everything that they've been taxing us on will actually stop. And that money will not be flowing to the federal government anymore.
So you're saying once we start...
Unfortunately, if you want, we could do this on your show. We can go into all these questions as you get smart on this. We ran out of time. I do apologize, because it's always when we get to that point of having, I think, the information delivered, we always get those questions. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.